the introduction means that we must try to express the meaning of what he does to us, then an introduction, an adequate introduction, is also impossible, because it is clearly impossible to compress into a speech of a few moments the vast wealth of his personality. An introduction is like a snapshot. A snapshot captures an instant in a person's life. And the best that we can do in making any statement about our Rebbe is to express an inadequately one aspect of what he means to us. I recall the rabbinic dictum, which is normally taken as an imperative, a command, or an obligation. We are not permitted to express more than mitzvah. But in this instance, it is not a question of an obligation, it is not a statement of an obligation, it is the assertion of a fact. In the case of our Rebbe, it is impossible to express more than mitzvah shachar. In which case, why do we engage in the business of introducing our Rebbe year after year at these conventions? What is the purpose of such an introduction? It is neither necessary nor really possible. The Torah, we have passages in the Torah which are ostensibly and apparently unnecessary as well. The people of Israel are counted on several occasions. And Rashi tells us that the purpose is simply mitov tifasan. And it is simply our deep gratitude and our profound appreciation for his many virtues which have meant so much to us that we take this occasion year after year to tell each other about the Rav, that which we already know. And let me just spend a moment doing that. There are two types of leaders. There is one type of leader who derives his authority from the force of personality. Another type of leader who derives his authority from the social order. In the political domain, it is the social order that confers authority on an individual. In the case of a monarchy, it is a person assumes sovereignty in virtue of the fact that his father was a monarch. In the case of a democracy, the social order confers authority on the person who has been elected. In Judaism, we recognize both types of authority. The authority that is rooted in the social order, the authority that is rooted in personality. And this is perhaps one of the distinctions between Kohen and Navi. The authority of a Kohen derives from the social order. His father was a Kohen. The authority of the Navi derives from personality. And as higher as the status of the Navi is over the Kohen, so is the status of the personality whose authority derives from personality higher than the individual whose authority derives from the social order. Our Rebbe's authority derives from the vast power of his incredible spiritual personality. And finally, there are two types of Gaonim. And the Gemara at the end of Brachos identifies, without using the word Gaon, identifies them as Sinai and as Ochir Harim. Rashi explains that Sinai is the equivalent of the Baki and the Ochir Harim is the analog of the Chadif. But I heard another interpretation recently. After all, Sinai is a Har, and Ochir Harim may very well refer to Sinai. There are two types of Gaonim. Those who live at Sinai and accumulate its vast harvest of Torah, and those who are Ochir Harim, they uproot Sinai, and by the power of their personality are able to transplant that vast harvest to generate new harvests all around the world. Our Rebbe is an Ochir Harim. It is indeed a privilege for me to present that personality whom all of us have the privilege of calling Rebbe, and who throughout the world is recognized, throughout the Jewish world, is recognized as the Rav.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Roth. This is supposed to be the... All right. Thank you. Appreciate greatly your introductory sentences. Yeah?
Oh, sorry.
Who?
This is enough.
This is enough. All right. I'll be frank with you, I've written out the address today and I'm a bit tired and exhausted. I just finished my shiurim last Wednesday, Thursday I gave the prina,
think.
So, I'm not sure that I'll be able, to perform the way I'm used to. What I'm trying to do tonight is simply to analyze a few rashis in the Parshas Aseres Adibreis. As a matter of fact, I worked out all the rashis in Parshas Aseres Adibreis, but I believe it will spend the evening on three or four short sentences of rashi. It's very important for us now, Rabbonim as well as people in the educational field, and even Talmidei Chachamim who are in the professions, to delve in Divrei Chazal, in the sayings of our sages and rabbis, to understand them well. We are very careful with Aloche. We have been very negligent as far as our God is concerned. And it's now an era in which tremendous problems arise. Society is in a state of flux. Many verities are being questioned. Many foundations are undermined. There is exploration, questing for objectives unknown to the people who do the questing. And the rabbi's task today is compounded, very complex. And it's important that he should be able to, not homiletically, but logically, philosophically, to take modern events and place them in our old biblical Talmudic Agadic frames of reference. I'm trying to do it tonight. The ideas I'll express are well known to all of us, but however, the frame of reference is new. The first pasuk of the Aseres Adibreis begins, "Vaydaber Elokim es hadvorim mo'il leimor." If you have the Rashi, Rashi says, "Ein Elokim elo Dayan." As a matter of fact, the four words plus a fifth word, "Ein Elokim elo Dayan li Porea," are quoted from the Mechilta. The rest is consists of Rashi's comments to the Mechilta. "Ein Elokim elo Dayan li Porea." Unquote, Mechilta. Now Rashi adds his own. "Lifishiyesh parshiyes shebatero shimosom odom mekabel schar vim lav eine mekabel aleem puronies." Yochel, there's some echo, couldn't be in this. There's a sound, there is a... Yochel af aseres adibris kach Talmud leimar. Put off the mic. Yochel af aseres adibris kach Talmud leimer vaydaber Elokim dayon li porea. It's very hard to guess. In my opinion, Rashi's text was identical with our text. Rashi added simply commentary. Perhaps Rashi had a different text of the Sifri. And it's a straight quote from the Sifri. Let me just, for the sake of those who don't belong to the Rabbinical Council of America, so I'll translate the Rashi. The word Elokim is the term for a judge. Since there are chapters in the Torah of such a character, that if a person observes the commands contained therein, he will receive a reward. And if he never observes them at all, he will not receive punishment on their account. One might think that the Ten Commandments are also of such a character, that no punishment will follow upon the infringement of them. Therefore, the Scripture expressly states, God spoke, God who is judge exacting punishment spoke. Do you understand the meaning? I don't. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to explain the Rashi, I want just to explain the Mechilte, Ein Elokim Da'in Liparea, but since we read the Rashi, Rashi most probably, as all Meforshim of Rashi assume, refers to, Rashi speaks about chapters, which, if one does not observe them, he's not punished. However, if he does comply with them, he receives a reward. And I could be misled into thinking, that Rashi says, that Aseres Adibreis, this chapter, belongs to that class, that the non-observance, one does not incur punishment by non-observance, but receives reward by observance. Therefore, that's why Vayidaber Elokim, Elokim spoke, Elokim means a judge exacting punishment. What chapters is Rashi speaking about? It's a mystery, an enigma. What chapter? Most probably, the commandments and the chapters referred by Rashi to are those which are to be observed only when the conditions specified are present. For instance, if one wears a garment four corners, he must provide the garment with scissors. However, if he doesn't wear the garment of four corners, he is not commanded to provide the garment with scissors. Yes, however, if he does put on a garment of four corners, and provides them with tzitzis, he receives reward. But the absence of the garment, by not wearing the garment, he does not incur punishment. Or for instance, if I build a house, and the house is a flat roof upon which people walk or people spend time, so I have to build a railing around in order to prevent people from falling. However, if I have no house or the roof is slanted, not flat, no people, walk on the roof, so there is no mitzvah mark. No mitzvah mark. If I build a house with a flat roof and I make a mark, I'm rewarded. But non-building, abstaining from building a house with a flat roof does not incur any punishment. Also, a mezuzah. If I live in a house and there is a door frame, I have to attach a mezuzah, and to nail down a mezuzah to the door frame. If there is no door frame, there is no mitzvah mezuzah. However, if I make a door frame, I fulfill a mitzvah, and of course, then I receive a reward. So what did Rashi say? I might assume that the Aseres Adibreis belong to that class of chapters. Rashi is speaking most probably, as all Meforshim say, of the so-called mitzvahs or shus, to use the term by the Rambam, the Maimonidean term, mitzvahs or shus. It means the mitzvah is binding only in a certain situation, under certain definitive circumstances. There is no duty upon me to involve myself in those circumstances in order to incur the imperative or the duty. However, if I do place myself in such a situation and I comply with the mitzvah, so the reward is assured. Where does Rashi, first of all, most commandments in the Aseres Adibreis are negative, laces. You cannot apply the whole idea to a laces. Lisirtsov, Signet, Sinov, the son of Bracha, Chokel, Lisachmi, I mean, what would Rashi expect with a Zera? I would not work. I'm not punished work. If I don't kill, I'm certainly not punished. But I don't receive a reward either for not killing. We have only three mitzvahs asay, three positive precepts in the Aseres Adiros. On Dechi, Shabbos and Kavod. What does Rashi think? Shabbos what? I'm not punished worse. If I infringe upon the mitzvah Shabbos, or Kavod Aveim, if I don't observe Kavod Aveim, what if I don't have a father and a mother on me? It's a different story. If one is an orphan, he cannot fulfill the mitzvah. We don't understand what Rashi means. First of all, 7 out of 10 are loving. Love. The whole problem of mitzvah shuset is inapplicable to love. 3 are absolute mitzvahs. They bind the person who, without having him become involved in a certain situation. We don't understand. As a matter of fact, I was not going to explain the Rashi to you. I suspect that Rashi is talking about something else. As a matter of fact, I haven't written it out. Rashi apparently thinks, since the Aseres HaDibreis are according to Rav Sadia Goyen and to Rashi, and Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam, the most Rishonim concur with him, so to say, the principles or the roots, I mean, of the system of Tayyad mitzvahs. It's a satero of a mitzvah. So each love in the Aseres HaDibreis somehow has a corresponding assay which requires of a person just opposite action, from action which is the reverse from that which has been prohibited by the law. For instance, the love of the Sirtzach, I mean, corresponds to certain assays, or rather has certain assays correspond, which require of men to support and to help and to promote and to save and to protect life, like the mitzvah pituach nefesh. Yes, sir. The same is true of the signet, and the same is true of the son of the Re'achoy Choker. On the contrary, she tells the truth, tzedek tzedek tirev, as far as the Sirtzah is concerned, the Samet al-Dam Re'acho, and so forth, ki yipel ha-nefo, the sisa makele gagecho, and so forth down. And each lisa say in the Aseres HaDibreis is linked up with an assay in other chapters, which requires of man he should engage in action which is the reverse, positive action which is the reverse of the sinful action which has been prohibited by the Aseres HaDibreis. And all those assays are binding. And if I don't fulfill the mitzvah assay, I'll be punished. This is the only way in which I can enter the Rashi. All right, but this is not my job tonight. What I want to interpret is the 5 words of the Mechilta, which Rashi quotes. If you have a Mechilta, you can see that the Mechilta does not have the rest. Mechilta has Ein Elikim Elodai Liporeya, correct? V'nemel Kabbalah. That's all. The name Elikim is indicative, according to the Mechilta, of judgment and a judge exacting punishment. In other words, so what does the Mechilta mean? Mechilta Rashi. What does the Mechilta mean? Exacting punishment. Of course, there is punishment for every mitzvah, for every violation, for every transgression, and for every fulfillment and implementation of a mitzvah, there is reward. In other words, the sinner is punished wherever Elikim appears in a parasha, or wherever Elikim decrees a law, prohibits certain action, recommends some action is the violation of any mitzvah decreed by Elohim is punished during the lifetime of the sinner. Bo'ilam hazeh, in this world, retribution is not delayed until man faces his maker in the world to come. Like the cases in other mitzvah, with regard to other mitzvahs. Hayim la'aseh som, today to practice, u'mocho, I mean, the next world, the Kadosh Chon, to receive reward. Those mitzvahs which are associated with the name Elohim, any violation of them incurs punishment immediately. Right here and now. That's all that the Mechilta has said. Because the rest consists of Rashi's additional comments. Let us analyze this Mechilta. Elohim is characteristic of the idea of retribution and reward which come swiftly during our lifetime. Why? Why? How did the Mechilta know that? Chazal have dwelt many times upon the distinction between the Shem Havaya, the Shem Ben Arba Esis, Tetragrammaton, and the Elohim. The Ramban quotes the Midrash in Dreshis that with the arrival of man upon earth, the name of God, which appears in the first chapter of Genesis as Elohim, was expanded into Adishem Elohim. The creation of man warranted the addition of Havaya to Elohim. The Ramban expresses himself succinctly by saying, Shem Molei al Elam Molei. The complete name began to prevail in a world which had been completed. Of course, completed with the creation of man. In other words, as long as man was absent from the world, God acted through the Midas Elohim, as Elohim. The very instant creation was completed by the emergence of man, God has begun to reveal himself not only as Elohim, but as Havaya Elohim. Creation became complete, so has the divine aim. In other words, God's relationship to creation is a dual one. As Elohim and as Havaya. Apparently, miyut, nature, both inorganic and organic, is ruled by the Shem Elohim. While nature plus man who is endowed with logos and speech is confronted not only by Elohim but by Havaya as well. What is the distinction between the encounter with Elohim and the encounter of man or confrontation of man with Havaya? Elohim denotes a relationship of might and power. For Aleph Lamed Keil, or even Elikim in Hebrew, we come across that the term quite often in Tanakh, has the connotation either of might, stupendous might, or of socio-political power, like being a judge or a ruler. Rashi himself says, "Beyim aseis adeshem melekim eretz v'shamoim, adeshem melekim, adeshem hushme." Havaye is the genuine name. Elekim, what does Elekim denote? Shalit v'shefet alkeinu. So Rashi expressed himself. Elekim has the connotation of shalit v'shefet, ruler and judge. Havaye is his name, whereas Elekim signifies that he is a ruler and a judge overall. In other words, the name of Elekim symbolizes two orders. First, the cosmic order. Second, the socio-political order. Let us see. First, Elikim stands for causality. This is the general principle governing the cosmic drama. This general principle is to be found in Elikim. For cosmic, it stands for cosmic dynamics, for the boundless reservoir of physical energy, for the natural drama, for the might and grandeur of the universe. In every aspect of the universe, you discover the fingerprint of Elikim. Elikim, in this context, is the legislator of the natural law, or of the mathematical equation which rules all cosmic phenomena, all cosmic events. Elikim determines physical events. Elikim reveals himself through the totality of the causal nexus and through the individual event per se. And what is, and this is very strange, people don't understand, and what is the natural law about which physics speaks, about which chemistry speaks, or biology, if not the expression of God's primordial will, which has been embedded in organic and inorganic matter? What is the fall of the stone, or the roar of the sea, the flight of the bird, and the circular motion of the insect around an electric bulb in a quiet, still summer night? The movements of my fingers, my urge for food, if not the manifestation of God's penetration into the depth of nature? Now, let us just speak about certain phenomenon which, prima facie appear to you to be very humorous or perhaps funny, but within the context of modern society, it's not funny at all. On the contrary, it is tragic. Violation of the natural law. One can violate not only the moral law or the religious law. One, human beings are capable of violating the natural law. Violation of the natural law results always in catastrophe. rebellion against the rule of Elohim, expressing itself through the causal link, through the dynamics of organic and inorganic matter, ends necessarily, inevitably, in disaster. The fires, for instance, of the law of, and please don't laugh at me, the fires of the law of gravitation, by leaping from the 10th floor to the sidewalk, will destroy, inevitably, a human life, instantly. Wouldn't take long. And a diabetic neglecting to observe a sugar-free diet will shorten his life and bring about death, if not instantaneously, at least gradually, peacefully. An alcoholic will finally develop some disease, like cirrhosis of the liver, and end his life tragically. And so God does not tolerate violators and transgressors of the natural law which he has established for the cosmos and man alike. And when I'm speaking about violators of the natural law, I want you to understand, don't look at me in amazement and good humor. I am not discussing now maniacs or psychopaths with suicidal tendencies who defy the natural law. The Vayemer Elokim Yehi. In our biblical lingo, the natural law means Vayemer Elokim Yehi. I am referring to historical eras, to cultural climates, to Hedonai-minded societies, which are driven almost compulsively to rebel against Elohim, as expressed through the natural law. What is cultural decadence? People speak many a time about cultural decadence. They speak about the cultural decadence of late Rome in antiquity. Now people begin to speak about cultural decadence of the Western world and about the United States. What is cultural decadence? What is it characteristic of? It is, of course, characteristic of a tired, frustrated society who was overambitious, overzealous, and tried to reach the impossible, standing on the brink of disaster, and trying very hard to violate the natural law. Decadence expresses itself in a tendency, in a quest, I would say in a compulsive drive, to defy the natural order, or rather to defy the authority of the one who has decreed that natural order. People try to defy not only the moral law, but the cosmic law as well. What is the curse, for instance? You read so much about it, and it is true. I don't know what men can do. I'm afraid it's too late. What is the curse of pollution? Who polluted the air? Who polluted the water? All right, you'll tell me industry. All right. But what happened? It's not industry. It's Mother Man. It's technologically minded man, men striving for power, for control, for absolute, complete control over the environment, men who simply defy the natural law. What is the evil contained in synthetic additives to food, which in many cases are detrimental to human health. What is wrong with them? I mean from a theological, metaphysical standpoint. I'm not speaking about what chemistry of food. What is wrong with the drive or with the urge to take toxic or intoxicating drugs? What is psychologically, what is metaphysically, what does lie at the root of such mad urges, such anomalous drives within man? And it's not limited now to a group of some psychopaths. It's now a universal phenomenon, a universal experience. I mean, it has penetrated not only the schools of America, but unfortunately the yeshivas of America as well. No one can protect. I mean, no yeshiva, no left or right, I mean, from or a little bit of precursors, I mean, is protected or shielded from that curse. As the rabbis, as people of God, we've got to understand it not only in psychological terms, usual psychological terms, can only explore the surface, not the depth, but from a theological viewpoint. This is the defiance of man, defiance of the authority of God. And it's funny that the defiance expresses itself not only in the downbringing of the moral law, but in transgressing and violating the cosmic law, the natural law. It is a rebellion against the rebellion, however. And such a rebellion which tries to change the natural law, the natural course of events and things, must end in disaster. Ein Elohim, if you try to interfere with the authority of Elohim, as expressed throughout the cosmic fabric of events and phenomena, Elohim Liporea is a very strict, severe judge who exacts punishment. In a word, the natural law is basically an existential law. Man cannot reject it without destroying himself. He either accepts the natural law, or he should be ready to terminate his own existence. Now, this is Elohim Shalit. But Rashi has said that Elohim is not only Shalit, but Elohim also is a Shafet. He is a judge. However, as we've remarked before, we find the name Elohim related to God's activity not only as a creator, architect, and master of the universe, but also as legislator, king and ruler of human society, of mankind as such. Elohim denotes both Shalit, unrestricted, cosmic, energistic might. He created, sustains, and supports the universe. Without him, creation would be terminated momentarily, and the world would be in shambles. As well, it denotes also social sovereignty and unlimited power at a socio-political level, as king, as almighty ruler and judge. You know very well that Elohim in Tanakh, in Chumash, has many times a dual meaning. Elohim leisekalel, very interesting, the Daloch has derived from Elohim leisekalel two prohibitions, two injunctions. One injunction against blasphemy. Elohim is meant, in this sense, Elohim is meant as, is to be interpreted as referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the king is a color, then color die, and George is man. The Nigash Balabai is the king. The Balabai should bring him before the court, before judges. As Elikim George, God is also a lawmaker, I would rather say a legislator. What law does he legislate? A shalit he legislates, or the natural law, the mathematical equation, the link between phenomena and the cosmos. As Elikim George Shifet, he legislates the moral law. His law is not about matter, is not related to matter, to the behavior of matter, but to the behavior of man. As a matter of fact, matter, inorganic, organic, is by far more obedient than man. We read in Parshas Noach about the seven universal principles, laws, principles of morality, which were addressed to Noach and his children. It's quite characteristic that suddenly the Torah changes the Shem Havaye into Elikim. Vayvorech Elikim esnei achves banav, before the Torah employs the Shem Havaye. The Torah begins to speak about this, the Sheva Mitzvah says, Tavu Bnei Noach. There is a sudden change, a sudden transformation. The Shem Havaye turns into Elikim. Vayvorech Elikim esnei achves banav, vayim alehem pru vu umiles oretz, mirachem vichitchem yiyo akolchai es oretz, vapalif ha-shomayim. ואף בוסו בנפשי דומה לשכנו, ואף הסדימכם לנפשי שיחם אדריש, מיד כלך יד ראשנו, מיד אודום, מיד איש אוכי ואדריש את נפש אודום, שיף אדם אודום באודום דומה ישופך, כבצלם אלקים עושה סלם. הווי is not mentioned. The moral social laws, which is the foundation, which are the foundation, of any civilized society were placed at the same level as the physical cosmic law. Elikim is the legislator of both, the law governing the gravitational pull, the electromagnetic field, which make the cosmic world function, and the law prohibiting, as well as the law prohibiting murder, which protects the viability of society. And here again, rebellion against Elikim as legislator of the social moral law ends in the same manner as disobedience concerning the natural law does, in catastrophe. Retribution, even for the transgression of the moral law, and I wish to warn, some people in the audience who are philosophers, that I'm not speaking about the natural law in the sense of Grotius or Cicero, or the medieval scholars. I cannot explain to you the difference because they take up too much time, but I'm speaking about a different concept. Retribution is swift and severe. A society which rejects arrogantly the law, for instance, thou shalt not kill or murder, falls apart as it seems. The Hitler Reich is the most characteristic case in point. Best example. An individual who is overambitious, overzealous, opportunistic, unconscientious as to the means he employs to promote and further his career will be finally cut in web of difficulties and contradictions. As a matter of fact, I believe that America's self-hatred, anomalous self-hatred of today, which is so evident on the campuses, and in literature, in the press, and her defeatist mood is a consequence of her arrogant and conceited, self-evaluation or self-assessment of yesteryear. Matter of fact, I don't recognize the Americans anymore. When I came to America, America was very self-assured, certain of himself. He thought that America has accomplished everything that is good in civilization and culture. That the rest of the world is just a bunch of illiterates who can hardly sign their names on a check. If they have checks, if there is money in the bank, I'm there. And the American life, American, there is American way of life. Or self-assessment of yesteryear. Matter of fact, I don't recognize the Americans anymore. When I came to America, America was very self-assured, certain of himself. He thought that America has accomplished everything that is good in civilization and culture. That the rest of the world is just a bunch of illiterates who can hardly sign their names on a check. If they have checks, if there is money in the bank, I'm here. And American life, American, there is American way of life, which is sacred, and has got to be imitated by everybody, by East and West, by North and South, that the educational system is the finest. Man enjoys unlimited liberty and freedom, and so forth and so on. Finally, America was identified and equated with the Golden Age, is the old paradise which was lost to man because of man's negligence and rebellion. This lost paradise was found in the United States. A lot of it was true. A lot was childish, infantile, naive. And a lot was due to arrogance. The arrogance in illiterate self-conceit. Now in America it's just the opposite. He became meditative, introspective, suffers from self-hatred, whatever is American is bad, whatever is foreign is good. He's exploring the world, for new deities, for new idols, and he's simply not sure of himself. In my opinion, if we believe in Ashgoche, in God's intervention in history, his penetration of human affairs, the mood of today is a result of the mood of yesteryear. One who rejects parental authority will meet with similar treatment on the part of his children. I have experienced that. I don't mean my personal life, but I saw people. Promiscuity leads to complete disintegration of the family fabric, and so forth. Elohim addresses himself to both, to nature and to man, and establishes laws for nature and man. He legislates both concerning the behavior of matter as well as the conduct of man. And violation of those laws, precipitate catastrophe and swift retribution. That's exactly what the Mechilta meant by Anechi Adeshem Melekech, Vaydaber Elekim Es Advorim Haile, Dayon Li Pora. The Aseres Adibris, before Why did Mechilta say it? Because before in Yisrael, the Shem Abai is employed, not the Shem Elokim. Suddenly, when the Torah is about to tell us the story of the Ten Commandments, of the revelation at Sinai, of the Decalogue which was bestowed upon the people, first on the people, the name is changed into Elokim. Apparently, those laws, those Aseres HaDibur, those ten principles, which constitute the foundation of any civilized existence, are placed at the same level as the laws governing nature. Elokim established the year, the velocity of light, of the electromagnetic energy, and Elokim established the law, thou shalt not murder. Retribution is swift in coming for both, for the violation of both. In short, the penalty is a natural one. The seed of destruction is inherent in the act of violation. It's not an extraneous penalty, but actually catastrophe is a part, is precipitated by violation, by violating the natural law. In short, the penalty is a natural one. However, when the legislator is Avaye, Avaye addresses himself to the people, Vayidaber Vayikro Avaye El Meshe, Odom Kiyakriv Mikem Korbim, then the commandment is addressed not to natural man, but to metaphysical man. To man who was chosen by God. Such mitzvahs as Tfil, Tzitzis, Sukkah, Shefer, such negative principles, precepts, as Nevele, as Dam, Chelev, Shatness and so forth, who were destined not to save a natural society from disintegration, but to raise the latter, the natural society, to a committed covenantal community. Those mitzvahs hallow and redeem the human spiritual personality. Non-compliance affects not natural man, but metaphysical man. It prevents man from achieving spiritual transcendental worth and distinction. It does not, you see, natural law, the moral law, the natural moral law, if violated, destroys human dignity. The metaphysical law, which is legislated by Avaye, destroys human sanctity, holiness. Hence, punishment is not immediate, not swift in coming. Punishment is delayed until that day on which human being will be confronted by his maker, and he'll have to account for all his deeds. The damage is metaphysical, the punishment is metaphysical in the world to come. Now let's take second Rashi. I'm through with the Mechilta. Open the Chumash. What is second Rashi?
No.
וידבר אלוקים אז כל הדבורים האלה לאמור מלמד שאומר הקדוש ברוך הוא עשרת הדיבריס בדיברכות מה שאפשר לאדם לאמור כן. The statement tells us that הקדוש ברוך הוא said all these words in one utterance, something that's impossible for the human being to do or to speak in this manner, correct? Now, I would advise you to stop here. This is again a Mechilta. first of all, always when I see a drosha b'chazal, an interpretation, a comment, I always ask, and you should also ask yourselves, what troubled Chazal, the Mechilat Rashi? Apparently something troubled. What actually prompted Rashi, motivated Rashi, the Mechilta, to say that from the Pasuk Vaidaber Elekim Eskol Advorim Oel Elemeir, you derive that all Ten Commandments were formulated and defined in one utterance simultaneously within an infinitesimal period of time.
The word call.
Call. Vaidaber Elekim Eskol Advorim Oel Elemeir. The call is completely superfluous. Vaidaber Elekim Eskol Advorim Oel Elemeir. And God has spoken the following words, or the words as follows. Now, when Chazal interpret a pasuk, I mean, we have no sense for Hebrew semantics now, but Chazal knew very well Hebrew semantics. So apparently, and always when they interpret a pasuk, and prima facie, it appears to us as if they made a twist. We should always look into the semantics of the word. And in all cases, we'll finally realize that there was no twist, but Chazal simply followed them in true semantics. The term call has a double meaning, has a twofold meaning, has twofold semantics in Hebrew. Who could help me out? Huh? Just one. Well, for instance, let's take a verse. Kol yesh ve'eretz ve'sheich netevel. Kinsei neisorim tiru v'chizkeyas shefer tishmo. What does it mean? All, in the sense, all dwellers of the earth and the residents of the world. In this context, call the notes what? Sum total of people, objects, etc. It is simply plain arithmetic. If you have a sum total, you'll say call. Second, call is used quite often as what?
Each one.
Each one means all, as they say. Each one is one. It's sum total. The call is integrated, you understand? It's integrated. Piecemeal integrated simply by applying the method of addition, of adding up. If I should add up, I mean, object to object, I mean, phenomenon to phenomenon, man to man, I'll finally arrive at the sum. The sum consists of an additive process of integration. And actually, it has been integrated of many parts.
Right?
Now, you say, Melei chal kol ha'ilom unu ye emphasize kulei b'chvedecha. What does it mean? Entire in the sense of wholeness. Intrinsic unity and oneness in totality. Proclaim thy kingdom over the whole world. And there is the Hebrew idiom, Al kol ha'ilom kulei, means whole world. Nothing should be left out. We have this expression in Chumash as well. I mean, I saw, for instance, one who edited the Marzah. I mean, eliminated the Kulei because he doesn't know Hebrew. Kulei Lam Kulei is copied from an idiom in Chumash. Ki cholo eido kulom gdeishim. Proclaim thy kingdom over the whole world. It's as a whole. As entirety, totality, but intrinsic totality, not integrated. It's not a sum, not the sum follows the parts, but on the contrary, the whole precedes the parts. It's not a sum total, but it is total in itself. And I'll give you an halachic example. I mean, it's not only a question of semantics. We have a rule, hubei kikulei. Here, you raise the rule. This rule of hubei kikulei is not applicable to any pure mathematical quantity. We employ this rule of hubei kikulei only in cases where in our halachic lingo jargon we say a heftze is involved. A heftze is required. I mean, but you know very well, I think that if we can say it only in our jargon, we cannot translate the term into another language, it means the term stands for nothing. If a term stands for an idea, I mean, it must be translatable into any language. What does heftze mean? A configurative whole, an entity which is intrinsically one. I'll give you an example. You can under no circumstances avail yourself of the principle of Rubik's Cube in a situation when a pure mathematical magnitude is to be dealt with. It would be absurd, completely absurd, to say that Rof Kazayis Matze suffices. You have to eat a Kazayis Matze. Why shouldn't a Rof suffice? Rubei Kikulei? You have to, what shall I say, you have to, a mikveh requires a boim so, you know. Why shouldn't 21 so's be sufficient in order to declare the mikveh kosher and perfect? What's the answer? It's ridiculous to speak about Rubei Kikulei with references to a sum, to a mathematical quantity, to mathematical measurements. If the lulav, if the hodesh should be 3 tefachim long, you cannot say the 2 is Rubei Kikulei, because 2 mathematically is not 3. There is no equation of 2 equal 3. You cannot have it. It's nonsensical. When do you apply the principle of Rubei Kikulei? For instance, Shchita, correct? Yeah. Question whether it is the principle, but all right, let's say I'll go along. It's Rubei Kikulei. In Rubei Kikulei, there's no mathematical quantity involved. The simonim is a heft, is an entity. The veshet and the kone, as an entity. In a holistic sense. As a configuration, as a whole, must be cut through. So the incision of Rav suffices. I say, Rubei shall dovo, shall heftze kekule. But you never say, now, lingo, that Rubei shall shiur kekule. Simonim are not a shiur, but two entities which have to be cut through on it. So you say Rubei Kikulei.
It's cut.
Yeah, it is. The Heftze, the entity, has been subjected to Shchita. But whenever there is Shiur, Shiur is a mathematical quantity, mathematical number, you cannot say 9 is like 10. It would be a lie.
How do we do
Mitzvah Sayyem
Kikulei? There is
a first of all, Mikseh Mikulei has nothing to do with Rubei Kikulei. Because for Rubei Kikulei you would need Rof, you would need at least six and a half hours here. But even at even Mikseh Sayyem Kikulei, you have in certain cases the thought, Kivim Sheova Rova Yem Bigdushe, because Yem is also an entity. Yem is completely not a sum total, because you have short and you have longs. Yain is not measured and determined by the number of hours, but it's a separate entity. It's a unity, I mean. It's a whole. In a holistic sense, I mean, in the sense of gestalt. There's another problem. For this is where do you apply Miktsayim Kikula, excuse me, Rubi Kikula, where else? Shchita, where else?
Rav
Kos, let us say. Rav Kos, Sahedana, Sahedana is a different sense of Chaim. Yes, that's I'm not responsible now for Rav Chaim. I'm responsible myself. When I have to defend him, I can defend him, but not tonight. But not tonight. Tonight I have a different job. So far. For this, of course. Arba case, because I smart, you don't apply Rubi Kikule. But as far as Arba cases are concerned, is the Sheise Rubi Kikule Shokos. That's the Rambam says. Vudi Shose Rubi the Kasa, the Gemara says. Why do you apply the principle of Rubi Kikule to Kos? Or you don't apply it to Kazai Smatze? Huh? Because, you see, the mitzvah, the Rambam has never said, and the Mishnah has never said, Val Yifchu Solei Arba Rivi Shal Yayin. The Mishnah and the Rambam always said, Val Yifchu Solei Arba Kese Shal Yayin. And the Rambam, in defining the duty of drinking four cups of wine, he says, V'chol echod v'echod b'Yisroel b'in anoshim b'inoshim chayovim lishteis balaylo hazeh arba kesi shal yayin. Of course, there is a minimum prescribed for the course. The course must contain not less than revis. The contents of the course must not be less than revis. But this is an element, an attribute, as they say, qualification as far as the course is concerned. Because if it's less than revis, it's not course. It's not course. It's not course. It's nothing. It's nothing. I mean, you reduce it to ad absurdum, you have to say. But once there is revis, you understand, once the course, the volume of the course equals revis, then the mitzvah expresses itself not in drinking a revis, but in drinking a cup of wine. And the course becomes, in a holistic sense, a configurative whole, a chepzer, a unity, an entity, to which we apply the principle of Rubi Kikule. And I'll give you an example. What, for instance, if the course contains not one revis, but five revis, or four revis? So most Rishonim, there are some who disagree, but most Rishonim say he has got to drink rov of the course of five revis. So what do you see from me? The inference is clear, I mean. And unequivocal, the mitzvah is not to drink revis. Revis is a qualification, is the minimum required for a course. Otherwise, it's not worthy, of the term course. However, the mitzvah refers to course as a whole. And that's why you indivisible whole. It's like in the sense of theory of Gestalt. And so you apply the principle of Rubi Kikule. Now, where else do you have Rubi Kikule? Rav Minyan, who you don't know. Basically, in Rav Sanhedrin, you mean Rav Sanhedrin? It's basically, without Rav Chaim, it is the aloha azlinim basaruge, not the aloha afrubi kikule. Alright, in order to ask a question and to object to me, you have to introduce Rav Chaim's there. And tonight I'm not ready to listen to them. The Mechilte and Rashi have interpreted, apparently, Vaydaber elekim eskol advorim o'ele, not in the sense that God spoke all those commandments, because it's completely unnecessary to say all those commandments. It would have sufficed if the Torah had said, "Vaydaber elekim es hadvorim o'ele," not call in the sense of some total, of an integrated sum, of a sum which was added up, a sum which is preceded by its component parts, where the individual objects have supremacy over the or over the psalm, or rather priority, I would say. Apart from the Hilton Rashi, we interpret the Vedaber Lekin as Kol Advorim or Ele in a holistic sense. And God, no, would you help me out? How, I mean, in English, the translation is possible. And God has proclaimed the whole or the entirety or the totality of those commandments. Of those commandments. Not each or every of those commandments. If call is not interpreted in the sense of every or all of them, A-L-L, but the totality, the organic unity, or the wholeness of the commandments, of all 10 commandments, then call is not superfluous at all. Call injects a new idea, opens up a new world to us. In a word, the 10 commandments have not been added up ex post facto. They are not an incidental sum of mutually unrelated precepts. The Decalogue constitutes rather a primordial entity whose unity and integrity are inherent in its very essence, or in the very essence of the system. In other words, there are not 10 commandments, basically. There is one commandment which branches out into 10 aspects. Of course, the consequence, the practical consequence, it's not a question of semantics anymore. The practical consequence is clear and obvious. I don't have to tell it to you, but I would like to dwell on that, because modern society is very much involved in it. The Decalogue is indivisible. You either accept all of the commandments or none at all. To choose between the commandments and to say Dein Hanyeli, Dein Le Hanyeli, certain commandments I like and I shall accept them, other commandments I dislike, I shall reject them, to assent to some and to ignore the other commandments is at best absurd. All of the precepts were pronounced and promulgated in one utterance, or within an indivisible, infinitesimal period of time. Of course, you know very well, throughout Jewish history, attempts have been made, and attempts still are being made, to split ourselves at the rest, you know that very well. To pick out those norms which have, in the opinion of dissidents, nonconformists of all epochs and generations, social moral relevance, and abandon the theological premise expressed in Onechi Eliyi Eloch Elohim Achirim Al Panai. And that's exactly what the Mishuta, of course. You take it literally, it was pronounced in one utterance, but for what for? HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't have to display his omnipotence that he can do it. What did this simultaneous proclamation of all Asaras HaDibreis accomplish? What did it convey to us? The organic unity and the indivisibility of the Decalogue. That is exactly what the Mechilta meant to say, that the Aseres HaDvorim were formulated simultaneously in one utterance. In other words, the Mechilta denies the vayis of what is actually in our daily language. What does the mechilta reject? What does the mechilta deny? What does the mechilta abandon? The mechilta denies the viability of a secular social morality. Once you divide Aseres HaDibros into two parts, and you separate the social norms from the so-called theological norms or ritual norms, or from the premise, mainly from the premise on Eichad Hashem Alekecho, on the Iyoloch, on Zohar Yassim HaShabbos Lekatshe, on the Siso Hashem Alekecho Lashov, the four cornerstones of our faith, of faith in God, so that the Alei Sirtzoch, and the Alei Signif, and the Alei Sinof, and the Alei Son of Rachai Checker, and the Alei Sachmet will vanish immediately. Either a man accepts the authority of God as the legislator of the moral norm, be it individual or social, or gives up his attempt to mold the moral conscience and to organize a society upon the foundations of a man-made relativistic morality. Now there are so many Rabbonim here and Tarshonim. This motif, which I somewhat isolated from the Maimer Shekulam Nemru, B'dibur Echad, in one utterance, is quite popular in Midrashic, in Talmudic literature. Could you quote me in other Maimorim which convey the same message, the inseparability of the moral norm from indomitable faith in God, or the indivisibility of the Aseres HaDvarim?
No.
The question is whether how the Aseres HaDvarim were arranged. I don't mean homiletical interpretations. I mean plain. No. Perhaps, but it's homiletical. It's drush.
That's the way they divide.
No, I'll tell you. There is instead of trying to simply to develop homiletical themes, I would suggest that we take it a sefte. Where is it a sefte? Just a moment. If you'll just have patience, bear with me. The sefte shuas peregimul alochehei. Peregimul alochehei. Very strange, the sect. Hananye ben Chachinoi. Eimeir. Nefesh kisimeil maal badishem. Vikichish ba'amise. Bepikodeine bitzumes yod. So he apparently didn't understand why is a maal or maal badishem. Nefesh kitichachish ba'amise. Bepikodeine bitzumes yod. To embezzle funds, embezzle objects, and deny, the facts. Ein adam kefer ba'amisei, ad she kefer b'iga. No, I'm not. Wherever there is real faith in God, there is no social immorality, there is no embezzlement, there is no denial of facts, there is no perjury. One doesn't take a false oath in order to suppress some information. Stealing, embezzling, perjury are the results of a secular ethic, of a man who wants to build his own moral world and wants to be the legislator of the moral law which he has to observe. And the Tesefta tells us a very strange story. Pamachas Shovas Reb Ruven. I believe it's the only time the name Reb Ruven is mentioned. Bitveria. He stopped in Tveria for Shabbos. Motzei Philosopher Sechot. Somehow. He met a philosopher. Probably an Epicurean philosopher. Omalei. So the philosopher asked him a very strange question. Eize Sonui. Who is to be held in contempt and hate?
Whom should society hate? Whom should society consider as a contemptible creature? Omalei, ze akefer b'mishebore, whoever denies the existence of the maker, of his maker. The atheist, Omalei heir, the philosophers didn't understand. Omalei, kabe de savicho, lisirtsof, lisinov, ein adam kefer bohem, achi kefer b'ikon. He was asked, most probably by an Epicurean philosopher, who is to be held in contempt? Who is deserving the hate of society and deserves to be excluded from society? Rabbi Reuven answered him immediately, the atheist, the agnostic, the skeptic, who denies the existence of his maker. The philosopher did not understand. The answer, why should a non-believer be held in contempt and hate, since faith is a private affair of the individual? His skepticism is not harmful to society. He expected Rabbi Reuven to answer, only a fiend of society, an arch criminal, who inflicts harm upon others, deserves to be hated. But not an innocent agnostic or atheist. The answer to this question came swiftly and unequivocally, and was stated in unequivocal terms. The absence of faith in God will lead finally to the downbreak of social morality. Corruption of man is ushered in by the loss of faith. All right, this is played, no? Okay, where's another maimer like that? After the Racha Kamecha and Hashem, yes, it's all right. But, because Eishek is, I doubt whether this is the answer to the problem. If Eishek is the problem, it's a very serious one. I believe, what? Yeah, correct. Yeah, if there is no Yiras Elokim, so they kill me. Yeah, this is plain. All right, press, yeah. Then there is a Gemara in Kiddushin. Dorashu le Rabbi Apischa de Venisiye. Yiduchu ad Hashem kol malchei haaretz. I mean, I want to show you, this was a thought not just expressed by one. This was the opinion which all Chachmei Chazal shared, that secular ethics is a hoax. It might function for some time, but will finally break down, and with its breakdown, society will simply go into a bottomless, will plunge into a bottomless abyss. Modern society has reached this stage. Dorash ule rabu apischa de venisiye. Yiducho ad Hashem kol malchei haaretz, ki shomru imre picho, mama picho lei ne'emar al imre picho, v'shosh omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu neichi v'li'i yoloch, omu umeseilom, lichvedatz meyuderesh. He's out for self-glorification. Kevon Shoma Kabede Sevicho Vesimecho Chosru Lidibri Sarashenes Rovo Mami Oche Reish Dvorcho Emes Reish Dvorcho Vele Seiv Dvorcho Elo Miseiv Dvorcho Nika Shereish Dvorcho Emes. Is it expressed succinctly and unequivocally? Because if you want to know how indispensable faith is, you just pay attention to the last few Dibres, whether they are observed and implemented by society or not, and complied with by society or not. Yeah. The gist of that maimer is identical with that of the previous saying by Rabbi Hananya ben Chachinoi, that social iniquity and immorality are precipitated by the denial of divine authority. In other words, the vehicle of social ethics is faith in a transcendental personal God who expects man to follow in his footsteps or to imitate him. At the beginning, the Malchers, the skeptics, says Aneche Veleyeh are socially irrelevant, since it's possible to organize a society on the foundations of a man-made morality. However, they have realized finally, later, that without Aneche, man forfeits his ethical sensitivity and becomes oblivious of the most elementary principles of morality. Yeah, this is correct. This is right. Does history confirm that viewpoint or not?
What's asking?
Does history confirm that viewpoint? This is our viewpoint, no doubt about. I don't believe I told you anything new. I believe the best illustration, the best proof is Russia. And I want you to understand, when people speak about bankruptcy of religion and about the failure on the part of clergymen, men of God, and there's a lot of truth to it, to the accusation, but as a whole, the accusation is false. And the best proof that such an accusation is false, and undeserving, is Russia again. I do not assert that the West has achieved great moral heights, Western society. Far be it from me. Western society is far from being perfect, a perfect moral community. It is hypocritical to a great extent, sanctimonious, deceited, and self-righteous. And quite often, as we have experienced it, indifferent to the woes and suffering of a downtrodden and weak people, as we have experienced it in the 40s. However, the West is still somewhat sensitive to moral issues. You can argue with the government of Britain. Can I? Whether the argument does good or not, I don't know. But at least you have the opportunity to argue. You may argue, you may debate with our State Department officials. Whether it's helpful or it's a waste of time, I don't know. Those people go to Washington. They should decide. I don't know. I've never met them. You may even engage Pompidou in an argument. Even Mrs. Pompidou. Because she's responsible for the commotion. He's a kind of a manea, Chayla Chacharishte, follows that. When she was in Chicago, and part of my manuscript, when she was in Chicago, and the demonstration took place, well, the demonstration was justified, warranted, it's a different problem, whether it was wise politically, it's a different problem. But the demonstration took place, and she passed for the police has cleared the path, and she passed on. She squeezed through them. So she said, she complained, they touched me. So I reminded myself, and I moved into the Cape to answer it. So the next door neighbor of mine was an old Irishman. But not, he was a descendant of old Irish stock who came to America before the Revolution. He was an Irish aristocrat. He used to say that his family came long before the Kennedy family came. And he was a gentleman, a perfect gentleman, aristocrat, and even looked typically Irish. The blue eyes, the pug nose, and the smile in his eyes. And so he used to tell me as a little boy, he was an old man, I was in his 70s when I met him. As a little boy, his mother used to take him to George Marsh's department store in Boston, where so many years ago, 60 or 70 years ago, only the clientele from Beacon Hill and Commonwealth and Beacon Street used to buy the Yankees, the Blue Bloods. So I used to come and some ladies came in fur coats, silk, velvet,
And sometimes he used to brush against them. So they used to take a look, a slanted look at him, and identifying him as an Irish boy, used to brush off. It's exactly what Miss Pampet said about the Jews. They touched me. Right, but still you can argue with them. The West tries at least to justify its actions or its inaction, to explain, to at least somehow to fool us, to deceive us. It feels many a time, and I'm ready to believe, embarrassed. And from time to time, the West is ready, even though feebly, to correct mistakes. What's about Russia? About Brezhnev, Khrushchev, Kosygin, Podgorny? Can one reproach her? Can you debate an issue with them? Any rebuke will be scornfully rejected. It engages in no debate. It distorts facts, falsifies historical data. Accusing, for instance, this was beautiful. Accusing little Israel of imperialism or colonialism, while she herself is the most brutal colonial imperialistic power, I would say, in human history. The Jews committed an international crime when they invaded Egypt in order to protect the lives of the Yishuv and prevent Nasser from massacring 2 million Jews. Because had Nasser won the war, it would be another Treblinka and Schwenzin plus Buchenwald and a few more camps, extermination camps in Eretz Israel. And Russia, of course, acted in accordance with international morality. It was motivated by the purest considerations when she occupied Czechoslovakia. Russia is immoral to its very bone marrow. Cruel and brutal. Completely insensitive to morality. Why? This is a strange question. Marxism? People make a mistake, because the term materialism is misleading. Marxism is fundamentally an ethical doctrine, but far more ethical than an economic doctrine. The underlying idea of Marxist economics and economic